his feet are too big for his bed. Nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head. They keep falling. So I just did me some talking to the sun. And I said I didn't like the way he got things done. Sleeping on the job. Those raindrops are falling on my head. They keep falling.
Welcome to Westerns with Dad. This is Matt.
And this is Dad.
And on this episode, the 1969 Western classic, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, directed by George Roy Hill and starring Paul Newman and Robert Redford at the height of their power.
Peak of their careers.
One of the greatest Westerns ever made, according to the AFI list. It's it's on
number
there.
49 on the list, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah, top 100. I was always under the impression this is largely agreed on to be one of the greatest Westerns ever made. And I've known people who have thought that. We've received emails on Westerns with Dad that have said, my favorite's Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. I did a little digging and researching, and I found out that was not always the case. This is a bit of a controversial film in some regards. I think now it's mostly regarded as a classic, but I read some reviews at the time that were just like, not having it, including Roger Ebert, a few other people, and I was just like, huh. How about that? It's interesting.
Ebert trashed it?
2.5 out of 5.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh. I was surprised by that. Said it was dumb and not believable and didn't thought the big chase in the middle just stopped the film in its tracks.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Now, I bring this up to start because, you know, this is a... I really like this movie. I think it's great. I don't know about greatest of all time, but I'm definitely on the pro side of this. I don't entirely know where you stand, Dad. I'm not entirely sure what you think of Butch Cassidy. I remember in the past hearing you say this was not all it was made out to be. This was not your favorite.
I love the movie.
Okay.
First of all, love okay. The movie. But the first time I saw it, I was put off by the soundtrack.
All right. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So it took a while for that to sink in. Now I can't imagine it without that soundtrack.
Okay, that's fair. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, it's a really good movie, right? Can we agree on that then? This is a pretty terrific... Uh-huh.
It's a great film, yeah.
I mean... I remember the first time I saw it, I thought it was pretty boring. I think I was like 9 years old, and it did not do it for me. I was just, this has no plot. Nothing's going on. I don't get it. I don't understand what's cool about this. And, you know, then the next time I saw it, you know, 15 years later, it's like, oh, no, I get exactly what's cool about this. Now I love this. This is, you know, this is the most romantic version of masculinity I've ever seen in a film. These are the coolest guys that ever lived. And watching it now, I think I've cooled off a little on that position, but it's still pretty great. It's still pretty terrific.
Yeah.
And these guys.
I didn't realize that William Golden won the Academy Award for this.
Yeah, this is the one he won for. This,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the musical one too, Dad.
Yeah, Burt Bacharach.
Yeah, and Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head,
which was still amazes me.
It's an annoying song. It's fun and it's a good scene, but it's just sort of a thing that gets stuck in your head, and not because you want it to.
No, I can't stand. It's an okay song, but it. It doesn't fit the movie.
I don't know. It's sort of a hangout of a film, episodic. It's kind of a takes place in a lull, you know, and in sort of an idyll.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what makes up this film. There's a lot of kind of how long would you say passes the amount of time that passes in this movie.
though. Let's see. Couple years?
It's a decade in real life.
Huh.
Yeah. They're in Bolivia for 8 years.
8 years, wow.
Yeah. That's you know, obviously it's not intended to be 8 years in the film. I mean, they stretch the truth quite a bit, actually. Despite the opening crawl, it says most of what happened is true. Nah.
Right.
Not totally. Not much at all. The basic shape of it all is true. And I think that opening crawl is just to add to the rascally good nature of the movie.
Right. Yeah. And there's still a lot of conjecture around their death.
Right. Oh, there's a great great conspiracy theory that we'll get to.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But I have a soft spot in my heart for this movie because I was in Utah in 1969 when this was released.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the places where they had the premiere was in Provo.
Yeah.
And they had a premiere at the theater on Center Street in Provo. They also had a simultaneous premiere at a drive-in just outside of Provo near Springville. And our band, Peace and Quiet, our rock band, was hired to play on top of the snack bar while we were waiting for the stars to show up. The stars were going to come out to the drive-in and they were going to talk and, you know, introduce themselves and the whole thing. And we got the high sign from the owner of the drive-in to knock it off and clear things away because the stars were rolling in. And so we watched their motorcade roll in, and I was winding up mic cords up on top.
Yeah.
When Robert Redford, who was the first one out of the car and up on top of the snack bar, came up on top of the snack bar, and the first thing he did was walk over and shake my hand. And he says, "How you doing?" And I said, "Fine, thanks. How about you?" He says, "Not too bad." And that was it. And coolest guy in the world at the time. And I was flabbergasted. They even have a picture of him somewhere. Robert Redford with me in the background winding up a mic cord.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. And this is a drive-through in Provo, Utah. Is that right?
A drive-in theater.
Yeah, drive-in, excuse me. We don't have them anymore, so, you know. That sounds like it was pretty gorgeous, I bet.
Let's see, who else was there? Natalie Wood was there. She wasn't in the movie, but a good friend of Redford's.
Jeez. Yeah.
Jeff Corey was there, the guy that played the sheriff that has him tie him up.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. The guy that played Harvey Logan was there.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Can't remember his name.
Not Paul Newman, sounds like.
No, Paul Newman wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nor was
Catherine Ross.
This is, I guess we should talk a little bit about this for people who aren't familiar, although I can't imagine who that would be, listening to a show such as ours. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid it's a story about outlaws. The Hole in the Wall gang, actually, historically known as the Wild Bunch. They changed the name because of the movie, to the name of the place that their hideout was. It was a hole in the wall. And it's basically a romanticized story about what happened to two of the most infamous outlaws that the American West generated. Probably not quite Jesse James. I mean, I would say actually that without this movie, I don't know that these are famous, but this movie kind of made them famous. Like,
right.
It kind of made the legend of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid based on just the success of this film, actually. And what it is in practice is it's just a great demonstration of the charm and charisma of Paul Newman and Robert Redford at the absolute most movie starist of movie star moments of their careers, you know, when they were, you know, what they looked to be about, you know, somewhere in between 30 and 40. Newman's a bit older, I guess. Peak charisma. It's a demonstration of that. I mean, about as strong of, you know, a pair of movie star performances as you've ever seen. And also, an elegiac story about the end of the Old West, I guess. Did I pronounce that word correctly? It's rarely one yep. that is said in conversation. It's more one you see written. but yeah, it's about the passing of an age and the end of an era, the end of this moment of great freedom and just adventurous. What would if frontier land again? You know that phrase that we always come back to, the the promise and allure of the magical Old West giving way to modernity, which, you know, I think we've spoken about this before, is often what the best westerns are about, the end of the West, and this moment in history being coming to a close. Which, of course, means this is a romanticized version of the West. This is right. about as romantic a Western as you get.
Yep, and I think that you can tell that there's that long scene when they're on their way down to Bolivia
mm-hmm.
that is just a series of snapshots.
Oh, the sepia montage, yeah.
The sepia montage with the... soundtrack going on in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of signifies the change of an era as well.
Yeah, uh-huh. It's getting into the turn of the century. It's and seeing all the newfangled contraptions coming out of New York City or whatever. One thing I love in there is where they're riding on like a World's Fair amusement park ride, which is just a
just a disc or something.
Just a disc that spins around, it looks like.
Yeah, it spins people off.
Yeah.
I used to have one of those at an amusement park north of Salt Lake.
It looks fun. It looks like a ride I want to go on. Looks dangerous, but all the best old-timey amusement park rides are kind of dangerous looking. you know, they're on boats and, you know, shooting galleries and, you know, that's a fun sequence.
yeah.
It's and yeah, like it's giving way to something, and there's less and less room for them, these outsized characters, as the world kind of closes in. I mean, that's what the film is in a nutshell, I guess. Is that,
well, it seems like they can sense it too. That's why they're going to Bolivia.
Yeah, it's they're getting chased the whole movie. You know, kind of by LaFours and this the super posse, but
right.
But more, they're just kind of getting chased by the end of things, like the new wave of the world. And their own fate and just destiny. It, you know, there's a sense that they're getting followed the whole film, and they're just trying to outrun this thing that is going to catch up with them inevitably, and they're going to see how far they can get, and whether that's 2 years or 8 years or however long, it's just a matter of time.
Yeah,
and I guess that's what Butch Cassidy's Sundance Kid is about. I guess if you had to say such a thing, but again, what's so appealing about this is just that it's hanging out with these incredibly charismatic, affable lead performances. Two actors who are just the best movie stars ever. They're so good looking in this.
They're really
capable. It's kind of stunning to watch. They seem like different species than the rest of the cast for the most part. Like they're alien gods or something.
You're right. Mm-hmm. I think it's written that way.
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And Goldman did a great job. The dialogue is amazing.
William Goldman, an amazing screenwriter, wrote this, wrote...
Princess Bride.
Princess Bride. Did he write Stand By Me? I think he did. Wrote Misery. He's one of the best.
Wrote Misery, huh?
He definitely wrote Misery, mm. Yeah. Uh-huh. He's... this is probably his most popular film. As we said, it's the one he won the Oscar for, and sort of the demonstrator of how, you know, how great he was. Although Princess Bride, I think, is gaining on that at this point.
Yeah.
You know, it's got 30 years of huge fans at this time. But this is kind of the one that made him. And it also made Robert Redford. Paul Newman was already there, but this was the Redford film. Did you know this wasn't supposed to be him? This wasn't just naturally like the two of them?
I heard something. Who was supposed to play the part?
Jack Lemmon.
Oh.
Yeah. It was going to be Newman and Jack Lemmon. And then it was going to be Newman and Warren Beatty?
No.
Yeah. He decided it was too much like Bonnie and Clyde, and he's right. And then it was going to be Newman and Steve McQueen. And McQueen insisted on top billing. Over
oh,
Newman,
boy.
And he was like, no.
What a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah, it's kind of some bullshit. Mm-hmm. I would say a mistake on McQueen's part. That guy needed more great films.
Yeah, he did.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's got The Great Escape.
That's a big mistake.
And what else? What's the other great Steve McQueen?
Sand Pebbles is supposed to be pretty good.
The Sand Pebbles is no Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
No.
Or, as it was known at the time... The Sundance Kid in Butch Cassidy, the original title.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
The Sundance Kid in Butch Cassidy?
Yeah. Swapped it because Newman was the bigger star. And they wanted him to play Butch Cassidy.
Huh. Hmm. It doesn't roll off the tongue as well as Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
No.
The Sundance Kid in Butch Cassidy.
But is that just because we've been hearing the name Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid for, 40 years.
Probably.
50 years. 50 years, I guess.
God. Yeah.
This is 48 years old, this movie.
Jeez.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, Redford's still kicking around, but...
Redford is still kicking around.
Looking his age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this was... they have a real reputation as being, like... You know, one of the great cinematic pairings, and it was just this and The Sting, if I'm correct.
I think that's just it. Those two films, yeah.
Well, those are two pretty good movies, yeah.
Yeah.
And they're
did
such.
Did The Sting win Best Picture?
The Sting won Best Picture.
Yeah,
this
that's
did
right.
not, but The Sting did, and I don't think either of them won for it. No, neither of them won for it, but I believe they were nominated.
Yeah.
They weren't for this.
No, neither one got a nomination, right?
Yeah, neither of them. Mm-hmm.
Huh.
No acting nominations for this. I mean, if you're not nominated one of those two, I don't know who you would, but Catherine Ross. Hey, you know what? She's great in this. I love Catherine Ross.
Yeah, she does a great job.
Mm-hmm. Made me want to see more things she was in, because other than this and The Graduate, I can't think of any, but she was in
Stepford
a bunch.
Wives.
Oh, is that her?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. She's terrific. Yeah. I like Catherine Ross. I don't know why she stopped making things. I know nothing about it. So, you know, hopefully she survived. and George Roy Hill is a director who was kind of like the guy for Newman and Redford after this. He did The Sting.
Right.
Slapshot and Great Waldo Pepper. He kind of made his bones on films with these guys. And he was a great filmmaker, too.
Huh.
But this was the one. This was the one where it all came together for this team.
Well, in the first one, right? First of all, those you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess The Sting won Best Picture. But I like this more. I think this is a better movie.
Well, they're both pretty good.
Yeah.
I like them both. I like them both.
Do you prefer Newman or Redford?
Oh, jeez.
Yeah!
I knew you were going to ask that question.
I prefer Newman.
Well, I was going to say Newman's got the best lines.
Newman's got all the best lines, yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, they're both pretty great, of course, obviously. Robert Redford's mustache in this is a fantastic mustache.
Yeah.
But man, Paul Newman is so cool in this movie. This is one of the coolest guys, like just dudes ever in a film. We don't have stars like him anymore. Guys that are this masculine and this like but also handsome and graceful but still tough. It's just everything you want to be. You know, he can pull it off.
Yeah.
I guess Hugh Jackman's kind of like that, but he's made way less good movies than Newman did.
I can never understand that about Hugh Jackman.
Why not better?
The guy's got so much talent. I don't understand why he's not in more classier movies.
Well, he's in a ton of movies. They're just not great a lot of the time. But he keeps getting to make movies because he's so good.
Yeah.
He does a Les Mis every now and then and can keep coasting. Well, no, what he does is he's just been playing Wolverine the whole time. And those movies always make a ton of money.
Right.
Did you see that last Wolverine? I think we talked about it. That one's awesome.
Logan is great.
Oh, man, what a good film.
Yeah.
Have
you seen the Showman?
I have not.
Greatest Showman?
No one seems to like it from what I've heard. Have you?
No, I haven't.
I might watch it one of these days just because Hugh Jackman's in it, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's a tremendous performer.
Yeah.
So, Butch Cassidy. I mean, we've been hitting a lot of the stuff in this, but let's take this point by point a little bit, you know, in our usual style. Go through what the film is. Okay, so it opens with this sepia, old timey like cinematograph view of. It's an opening narration saying, "Well, this is the Holdenwall gang. They're all dead now, but back in the day, they were quite the gang." And
they ruled the West.
Yeah, that's it. And it uses this sepia occasionally. The first 5 minutes or so of the film stays in this old-timey thing. It's a device they use in The Sting as well, a similar thing. What do you think of this? Does it place you in a time and place, or is it draw attention to itself? I couldn't decide.
Oh, I liked it. I liked the opening. It's not the actors in the film.
Right.
I wondered the first time I saw it if it was an actual, you know, chunk of film that they discovered. You know.
They do a similar thing in Tombstone, if you recall.
Yeah, that's right.
And that is interspersed with actors in the film and stuff shot at the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we get introduced to these characters over some Burt Bacharach score, you know, which, as you said, does not sound at all like you would expect a Western to. It's very 60s and flowery, and, you know, not just raindrops keep falling on your head. There's all sorts of it. You know, it sounds like Burt Bacharach. It sounds like
right, you know, jazz.
Uh huh. Like an Austin Powers movie. It's you know. It's the 60s personified in music, and I guess this was something that just wasn't done. You know, we're used to Elmer Bernstein scores, you know, John Wayne scores.
Right.
Yeah, and that's kind of what made this feel new. I mean, this was 69, so we're not really getting into deconstruction in the terms that we're familiar with it, but this is kind of a deconstruction of a Western. I mean, to some extent, just in that it's, you know, it's about the ending of something rather than a story of, you know, just an adventure yarn. It's about like a time slipping through their fingers, you know. It's and the march of towards the modern age,
right?
And I guess that counts. Or it's new ideas in a Western. And that probably exists most in the score than anywhere else, I guess.
That's the most evident, it mm-hmm. seems.
Another thing that is interesting about this movie, I was looking at our back catalog here, episodes we've done, we've done a lot of movies about lawmen, talked a lot about, sheriffs and marshals and various characters of that type. We've talked a lot about bounty hunters. Those are quite popular as well. We have not spent many conversations talking about bad guys, robbers, bandits, a gang, like the Hole in the Wall gang. They are rarely the protagonists. I think
that's true.
I think you kind of tend to think of them as, one of the major archetypes of the Old West, or rather of Western films. There are not too many that are about the robbers, that are about the hired crooks, the bank robbers, the bad guys. It's not
right.
It's not often done, even though you kind of think of it as a major part, and because they show up in the Marshall stories and the bounty hunter stories, but they're rarely front and center.
Or there'll be just a short segment of a film where you get an insight into one of the bank robbers or something, mm-hmm. who then turns into a good guy.
That can happen, yeah. Uh-huh. John Wayne almost never played a bad guy, or a bank robber or anything like that. Three Godfathers is the only one I could think of, a film that we spoke of last year, or 2 years ago now, Jimmy Stewart would play that like a character pretending to be a bank robber, maybe.
Right.
But not really. And Clint Eastwood.
Randolph Scott did it several times.
Oh, yeah? He played bank robbers?
Pretended to be an outlaw.
Yeah, uh-huh. I mean, I think that, ultimately, Westerns tend to be kind of conservative, and it's rarely a conservative, idea to empathize with the scofflaws, if you will, the people that are not standing for authority, that are standing for themselves. You mm-hmm. often find those characters on the opposite end. This puts them, in right in the front, and also really makes them sympathetic. These are Butch Cassidy does not kill anybody in this film. Neither of them do, actually, until the very, very end. And up until that point, we don't see anybody get killed by these guys.
They get the banditos.
Yeah, and it's a big moment. It's a huge moment when that happens.
Well, in fact, isn't that where Butch Cassidy turns to Sundance and says, "I got to tell you something, I've never shot anybody before."
Yeah, uh-huh. On the one hand is, it makes that moment great. On the other hand, it's like, how many years were you a bank robber leading a gang of bank robbers? To some extent, it goes out of its way to make them very sympathetic. So that doesn't feel too deconstruction-y to me, that they're still heroes, even though they're bank robbers. Like Frank and Jesse James, you see them in the movie, they're killing people left and right, even if you're supposed to like them. These are squeaky clean. As far I think we are to assume that Sundance has killed more than his share, but we never see it until the end when he's, acting in self-defense, pretty much. His introduction scene in this film, as a matter of fact, is he getting accused of cheating in a bar. Such a Western scene, and the guy accuses him of cheating after he wins a game of cards, and then when he realizes it's the Sundance Kid, he's like, I didn't know you were the Sundance Kid, and
you just got to ask us to stick around. That's all.
And it becomes a tense standoff where they're kind of just like, oh. We didn't know you were the best who ever was. Sorry about that. And then, And it has that great button at the end, which is, as they're leaving, as they're walking out the door, the guy's just like, hey, kid, how good are you? And he turns around, shoots his guns off of his hip, and shoots them across the floor.
Yeah.
That's a good introduction. That's a really good introduction to, well, one of the great stars of the 70s, I guess. Robert Redford.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we establish who these guys are pretty early, you know, like, Butch is the dreamer, the affable guy, affable is the word used repeatedly to describe him, then. The jokey one, you know, the funny one.
Keeps things light, yeah.
Uh-huh. Whereas Sundance is kinda, he's more serious.
Moody.
Mm-hmm. Moody, yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Not in a heavy way, though, because he's Robert Redford. you know, being a very charming young man. But neither of these are overplayed. It just seems like natural extensions of the actors' personalities and personas and what they bring to a film. And it totally works. We also get that big knife fight with what's the guy's name?
Harvey Logan.
Harvey Logan
is the character's name. Mm-hmm. I can't remember who played him.
Yeah, uh-huh. Which is that the hole in the wall gang is tired of waiting for the next job and challenges Butch's leadership and challenges him to a knife fight, which he kind of cheats his way around a little bit cleverly.
yeah, kicks him in the balls, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. And yeah, again, this is the sort of thing that I think only works because it's Paul Newman doing it, and it's impeccably shot and choreographed. I mean, it's just a really professional movie, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they're the Logan wants he has a plan to hit a train twice, once on the way out and once on the way back, because they won't suspect it, and after beating his ass, Butch says, "We'll just do that."
Yeah, yeah. Harvey thought of that?
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
That sounds good.
Yeah. And so we get some train robberies right off. Good ones.
Poor Woodcock.
Woodcock, yeah. Uh-huh. they're trying to... There's a guy he's locked in the cabin with the vault. Sort of a corporate stooge named Woodcock, and they have a real friendly banter with him, trying to get him to open up. And then like, well, we're gonna have to blow up the door if you don't. Come on, Woodcock, and he won't let him in. So they blow it up, and they don't quite kill him. He's fine. and this is all good times at this point, right? This is.
So far, yep.
I mean, they're basically Tom and Huck in these, yeah. You know, in these robberies, and the, you know, or Robin Hood almost, except they keep the money. and like, there's this following scene right after the robbery where the sheriff is trying to raise a posse to go after him in the town center, and nobody wants to do it, and they're just sitting. They're sitting at a bar on a rooftop. Watching this happen and having a great time and partying, it's and it's the posse thing is going badly. Like you know, halfway through, a guy gets up and tries to sell a bicycle, and it's, they're having a good laugh at it. This is hijinks and shenanigans. there's a scene where Sundance sneaks into Catherine Ross's bedroom. And forces her to undress at gunpoint, and for a moment, you're like, "Oh, is this gonna be like an uncomfortable '70s weird sex rapey thing?" And then nope, turns out that it's that she's his girlfriend, and this is part of their pillow games. This is,
just once I wish you'd get here on time. Yeah,
yeah, it's part of their flirtations. What's going on with her and Butch, by the way? Like, she's definitely Sundance's girlfriend. What's up with her and Butch?
Good friends.
Really good friends.
Really good friends, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, she actually asked the question, right? What do you think would have happened if we'd been the two to get involved before? You know, if we'd gotten involved before I met Sundance. And he never really answers the question.
No. And yeah, he, like, after she spends the night with Sundance, he shows up on a bicycle and just takes her out. Like, wakes her up and says, "Hey, come ride with me on this bicycle." And, you know, then that's the famous "raindrops keep falling on my head" sequence, which is a bunch of Paul Newman having fun on a bike and riding around with this girl while the Burt Bacharach song plays. And it's strange. This is one of the weirdest scenes. It's famous now, but coming in the context of a Western, it's very surprising, especially after the train robbery. And
that was part of my reservations the first time I saw it.
Yeah?
Yeah. It just didn't fit for me.
It's pretty hippy-dippy, I have to admit. It's
Yeah. Hippy-dippy, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you watch it now and it's the bicycle scene from Butch Cassidy. It's famous, but
that's right.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Exactly. just like the soundtrack throughout is famous now.
And you know? And you also got, you know, Paul Newman being Paul Newman during it, which you know, certainly helps. And so then they rob the same train again, use too many explosives and blow up the whole deal, including, well, not Woodcock makes it.
Does he make it through the second one?
I don't know. Imagine. He kind of disappears. Maybe that's a guy they kill and they just don't dwell on it. I think he makes it. No, that he comes out. He comes out of the... they get him out this time.
Before they set off the dynamite?
Yeah, uh-huh. The whole time he's talking about how much he loves them and thinks they're great. And, man, if I could give this money to anybody, it'd be you guys. You know that. But after they blew him up. Because they're so charming. And this is an excellent stunt that happens here, by the way. The explosion right in Butch's face.
Right.
Where he gets blown down the hill. Somebody did that. I mean, it wasn't Paul Newman, but it was somebody.
Yeah. They blow up the safe and all the money inside it.
Mm-hmm. Which is like, it's just a funny thing. You know, it's just, they laugh that right off, because that's the kind of gang they are.
what does Sundance say? He says, "Did you get enough dynamite there, Butch?"
I really like the dialogue in this. I think we've talked about this a little, just mentioned, but the light touch comedy is really, really winning.
Because this is never cheek stuff is great.
Yeah. Uh-huh. There's a real familiarity, and these guys, you know, they know how to deliver a line that isn't a punchline, but is still going to get a laugh really well. And then another train shows up, and a bunch of horses jump out of the train and start chasing them.
And here we go on the chase.
Mm-hmm. And what this is the beginning of the lengthy midsection chase of this film. It's probably about 40 minutes or so of them being chased by a super posse, if you will.
Right.
Led by a guy in a white hat. Joe LaFours, as we come to find out.
And, right.
He's kind of the personification of destiny or the end of the road, or just, you know, whatever is
waiting. He is for them.
Yeah, uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah, they never see his face. They just know that he's out there hunting them. And always will be, or so it would seem. But it's never...
Until they're dead,
It's never... there's never any implication of that. It's always quite clearly a guy named Joe LaFours, you know? Any sort of extra meaning is entirely thematic. There's no, you know, it's like the exact opposite of High Plains Drifter, for example, which was, I mean, the thematic ideas were basically just the text of the thing, you know, like he is the devil or something, and there's hardly any other way to interpret that film. Here, you know, any sort of secondary meaning to what characters are or what the themes are is entirely secondary. It's something that, you know, I'm applying myself when I'm watching the film.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. They both work. I think that both approaches work. This one works quite well. Who are those guys?
Who are those guys? Yeah. And the tracker, Lord Baltimore.
Yeah, Lord Baltimore, an Indian tracker back in the day, but he only works out of Oklahoma. That can't be him, can it?
Turns out it is.
Yeah. And it is Joe LaForest, even though he never leaves Wyoming. You can tell by that white straw hat. They find out that the guy who runs the train, or the railroad, the Union Pacific Railroad, a guy named
E.H. Harriman.
E.H. Harriman hired a dream team to hunt them down because he's tired of getting stolen from him. He's tired of these guys, and specifically wants to kind of get his vengeance. I believe as Butch says, like, oh man, if he just paid me what he paid them posse, I would have stopped robbing him for sure. And
yeah. Yeah, what did he say? If you paid me what he's paying them to stop robbing him, I'd stop robbing him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good, well-written line, as opposed to what and this is the part Ebert objected to so much. It's a long sequence of running over hills and riding horses up bluffs and climbing up trees and looking off in the distance and being like, hey, what are they doing? Are they still chasing us? And it's notable because it goes on so long, but it's also has the nice distraction of being shot in beautiful country. Probably the most scenic sequences of the film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Ebert's got a point. I don't think it was ever boring for me.
No.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But it does take up a lot of time in the movie.
It really does.
And could be shortened by, you know, 10, 15 minutes probably.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing, it's obviously an intentional thing. Like, they're aiming for something with that, you know. They want it to be, they want it to go on too long, or to longer than you would expect or anticipate. I mean, at the least, what it does is imply, like, you know, just how serious these guys are, and how you know, and how desperate this is. But also, I think in the latter part of the film, just the fact of this long chase kind of sticks with them, you know, like they feel hunted the rest of their lives as a result of this.
Even at the very end of the film, right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
He says, is that LaForest out there?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. For a while there, I thought we were in trouble.
Yeah. Last line. Yeah. And it comes to a conclusion on this mountain bluff. One of the most famous scenes in the film. Climbing up above a series of rapids, on top of a big rocky outcropping, and they're cornered, they're being surrounded. The posse is splitting up so they can pick them off, and they decide that they're going to jump off of this cliff into the pond, into the river, roaring river, to escape. And they might die doing it, but it's the best chance they have, and it's just a really charming, funny scene.
Classic scene.
Yeah.
Classic scene.
I can't swim. You're crazy. The fall will kill us. It's, yeah. And yeah, it's the closest there is to an action scene in this, I guess. well, until the end.
Yeah.
And yeah, and that sort of ends the first half of the movie, I guess. To the extent that this is sort of an episodic thing. And
yeah.
And yeah, they decide it's time to go to Bolivia after that. There is a key scene in there, by the way, that we skipped over, which is where they're talking to the sheriff. Is that Jeff Corey? They try to make a deal to join the army.
Right.
It's like, yeah, they won't take you. They won't take you because you're just two bad outlaws. No matter what, no matter how nice you are, no matter how good you had it, you'll always be two bad outlaws. Your time's over. You're going to die bloody. Yeah. Which is like, okay, that's what the movie's about. It's
all the while, he's having him truss him up. So it looks like they attacked him. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They decide to get Catherine Ross to go with them. Etta Place, the school teacher, that's the character's name. And, you know, she Sundance's boyfriend, but she's just as emotionally attached to Butch, it seems. And she's just kind of like, yeah, why not? I've never had more fun.
Well, she speaks some Spanish, for one thing.
Yeah, She's enjoyed her life more with them than without than any other part of her life, and so she's just like, okay, I'll do it. And they'll say she can come as long as she doesn't whine. and she'll be like, yeah, I'll come. Okay, I'll do all the women's jobs. I'll fix your socks, and I won't whine. But there's one thing I won't do, and that's watch you die. You understand, Butch?
Yeah.
Prophetic words. Is that because she knows they're going to die, or is it just, no, that's later that she knows they're going to die.
Yeah, when she takes off from Bolivia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's when she knows.
Yeah. Do you prefer the first half of this film, with the train robberies and the chase by LaFours and the raindrops keep falling to your head? Or do you prefer the second half of Bolivia, where the romantic illusions are starting to fall apart and things aren't as good as they had hoped, and ultimately they end up meeting their destiny at that restaurant?
I kind of gravitate toward the second half.
Yeah, it's pretty, I don't know. I guess I think that what gives the second half its power is the first half, though, now that I think about it. You know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, the two parts together is kind of what makes it a whole thing.
Right.
On their own, yeah. They aren't really.
You got to have them both together.
Uh-huh. And yeah, I mean, that's basically what it is. You know, they arrive in Bolivia, and it's not as cool as they'd hoped. Everyone speaks Spanish, which they don't speak. And all the things they head out to end up being run down, or, you know, there's pigs and llamas running all over the place, the property they bought, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, they're ineffective as bank robbers because they don't speak the language, and she teaches them some Spanish, but they're bad students, so they don't pick up on it. They're reading off of cue cards. It's kind of like a Coen Brothers. It's like Raising Arizona. Or so. It's not as good as it used to be, even though they are still gentlemanly robbers and quite charming and affable. You know, they're scamps. It's so they kind of get the hang of it, but. And yeah, and this is the point where you're kind of like, you know, I still haven't seen them hurt anybody in this. And then they see a straw hat, a white straw hat, on the other side of the street, and like, oh shit, it's LaFours. Is it LaFours?
No.
No? You don't think?
I don't think it is.
They're just spooked. I like that better. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I think they're just spooked.
Mm-hmm.
Although it does, I was reading in Wikipedia, talks about the Bolivia thing, that Pinkerton actually trailed him to South America.
Hmm. Oh, yeah? Maybe it was LaFour's.
Maybe it was.
I guess the point is they don't know, and so neither do we. Like, that's...
Right.
Is it their paranoia, or are they just going to be chased forever by this guy?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they decide to go straight, which is a pretty funny plan. It's like, well, they got to wait for us to do something. He's just going to be waiting forever, and we'll go straight. It'll drive him nuts. So they get a job working for Strother Martin, which is...
An American working for a silver mine, right?
Yeah, uh-huh, as payroll guards, which is, you know, ha-ha, irony. And this was based on a real guy, apparently.
Oh, really?
Percy. Yeah. And he is the guy who ultimately confirmed that they were indeed the corpses that had just been killed. When Butch Cassidy and Sundance are killed in a shootout.
Is that right?
Spoiler, so that's how the movie ends. this guy, who does not die in real life, was the guy who identified the corpses. And he is sort of the center linchpin of the conspiracy theory that they did not get killed.
Well, wait a minute, he identifies their corpses.
Yeah, or he lied about it because he liked them. Because he was there, he was working with them. I mean, that's it. That's the conspiracy theory, basically. That they faked their death. Uh-huh. And yeah, as it turns out, they're not very good at being payroll guards. Because in the film, this character, Percy, is just killed. He's murdered by bandits as they're escorting him back. And they go and they reclaim the gold by killing all the bandits. And they feel real bad about it. which is actually a very good scene. It's, you know, like, well, I guess that's going straight. What do we do next? it's an odd bit, no, that going straight makes them guilty. It makes them killers. Even though you can
kind of
presume that they had been killers. And I guess that's just the sort of irony that this movie kind of just delights in, you know? It's just, it doesn't necessarily mean anything other than irony.
Huh? Right.
And this is where Etta decides she's not going to stick around, you know, because they're going back to it. You know, they're not built to go straight. They're just going to keep looking for banks. And she's like, I think I'm going to go back ahead of you guys. I think I'm just going to go out in front of you, because she knows it's coming. You know, she knows that, you know, that this is not sustainable, and they're going to go down. And that, of course, is exactly what happens. They get pegged. Yeah. They get pegged over some business with a mule, and they get cornered at an open air restaurant, run into, and they start getting shot at by Bolivian soldiers who have been tipped off that they're there. They run into
by local police, and then the soldiers show up.
That's right. Yes. They're the Bandidos Yankees. Their wanted posters are all over Bolivia, and they've been cornered in this hotel. It's a hotel, right?
I don't know what it is, to tell you the truth.
It's a building of some kind. They have to run out and go get their ammunition. They both take some wounds in doing it. They start killing people for real now. You know, like the guys that are surrounding them, they're taking them out, or at least Sundance is. They're both wounded, and they have a... And while they're waiting in there, then the Bolivian army gets informed, and then, you know, I don't know, like 100 extra guys show up. They're all got their guns pointed at the place, and and they have this charming conversation about, well, next, now let's try Australia. yeah, they speak English there. It'll be better for us. And, oh, man, you think it's the fours out there? Nah. For a moment there, thought we were in trouble.
Yeah.
And they run out the door, and there's a freeze frame on them in action, and you hear them just get mowed down. And it's one of the most famous endings in any Western.
Yeah. Fuego!
Oh, it's so cool. It's such a good ending. Oh, it's so great. and it's one of those that's just so cool. You know, it's thematically, you know, yeah, they were going there. You know, this has been chasing them the whole movie, their death. You know, the end of what they are. But as it is represented here, it's just so cool.
Yeah. Even really powerful way of doing it.
Do you think they know they're running to their death there? Because the Australia talk seems so earnest. It seems like they so believe it that's going to happen.
Well, they have no idea they're surrounded by an army now.
They don't. Right. Mm-hmm.
So it could be that they really think they're going to make it to their horses and and get out of there. But
if they think they're about to die, they do not give that away. Like they don't communicate that.
Right. Well, I don't know.
I don't know either. Probably not. I would lean towards they don't know, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure. That is how they would meet their deaths. If they, you know, if they knew, they wouldn't behave too much differently, I don't think.
Probably not.
Yeah, they would have wry comments and a couple jokes and camaraderie, and they wouldn't make too big of a deal out of it, and they wouldn't think about it, and they would just go out there.
No. Especially these characters.
Yeah. I imagine the real-life Butch Cassidy and... the Sundance Kid, Wagenbaugh was his name.
Longenbaugh.
I bet they were nothing like these guys. Absolutely nothing.
Right.
I bet they were just very successful murderers, and there was very little charming or affable about them.
Well, let's see. What did I read in Wikipedia that sort of belies that there are a lot of conspiracy theories that he didn't die in Bolivia, that he made it back to the States, and that he actually went back to Circleville, Utah, where his family had a ranch originally, and you know, he went to go see his brother and drove up in a Model T Ford and the whole thing, and that he was, you know, people trying to protect him.
Is this like, do you think Davy Crockett didn't die at the Alamo kind of talk? Is this wishful thinking? Like these people are bigger than life, or like Walt Disney's still alive? One of those kind of rumors, you know? There's like these larger than life figures, you know, that they haven't left us yet. No. He made it out. It's a tall tale, you know. Like that's not what I heard. Jeremiah Johnson, he's still up there.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
but the rumors persist, and there have been several books written about it.
I would. I have to admit, I don't know a lot about these characters in their real life components. I know counterparts. There is a lot of information and material out there for you. I kind of was just like, I'm gonna focus on the movie right now, but
right,
you know, because I'm starting a new job and stuff, but. There is an endless amount of information. There's all sorts of documentaries, you know, like hour-longs that I found, you know, littering Amazon Prime, which is where I watch this, by the way, Amazon Prime, to be perused, you know, and you can see arguments pro and con about whether they made it out of Bolivia alive or not. Ultimately... for me, this is the end. You know, this is how they went down, because it doesn't matter on the one hand, and you know, they these guys, you know, dead 100 years at this point, over 100 years, exist in the world of legend, and this is the best ending for that legend. Probably because it was just a really effective scene in this film.
Yeah. Yeah, could be. Nothing said about Sundance.
Right. Right.
You know, it's always Butch Cassidy they talk about. And whether or not he made it out or not. There's a book written by his sister, I think, or something, about him making it out.
Hmm.
Making it back to the States.
That's interesting. I didn't know it was from his sister. But how did we even know it was his sister? Records being what they were at the time. Intriguing. Intriguing film. Also, this is something the film doesn't play with at all. They die in the movie. There's no question.
Yeah.
This is, like, yeah, you mentioned Davy Crockett. Davy Crockett is a more ambiguous ending than this one. This is, there's no two ways about this one. And again, these characters, the whole movie, they're running from the end. You know, they're running from the end. And the end is inevitable, ultimately. So I'm glad that they didn't mess with that, to be honest. I think that this is the right ending for this film and the way it was being presented.
Oh, I think so, too, yeah.
All right. Do you have anything else to say about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid?
No, it improves with age for me.
I agree. And my age. The older I get, I think, the more I appreciate this. Although I will say, this is a great movie to watch in your 20s, in your early 20s, I think. This is instructive on how to be a man, in a way. You know, this is such an idealized and positive view of masculinity. You know, like, these guys are great men, you know. This is a kind of movie you should watch at that point in your life, I feel like, to the extent that a movie can help you in any way in that regard. but yeah, I mean, I had a good experience, I remember, in college, you know, in graduate school. We watched this a couple times over the course of a few years, and it was just like, you know, dudes drinking whiskey and watching Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. It was really good, actually. I have fond memories of that. Mm-hmm. How many stars? I go 4 out of 5.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
I even feel like I'm going a little low there, but, you know, honestly, I think it's a 4 out of 5 for me. I'm not...
Yep, same here.
Yeah. I can't say I'm overwhelmingly emotionally involved in these guys. I'm, you know, like I say, I think I want them to die at the end. Even though I like them very much. But ultimately, you know, it's a must-see. It's a must-see Western.
Yep.
It's
I agree. 4 out of 5. Even though I've made my peace with the soundtrack and everything, you know, they're still lingering. Yeah, it is. And Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head is still a mistake as far as I'm concerned.
You'll hear it at the beginning and end of this episode. Well, beginning or the end. I'm not sure which yet. All right. So there you go. Butch Cassidy, the Sundance Kid, 4 out of 5. This was an episode that was requested a few times. A lot of people like this movie. We have gotten emails on the, hey, why don't you do Butch Cassidy? And yes, I agree. We've been meaning to, and now we have. If you would like to recommend episodes, films that you would like to hear us talk about, please let us know by emailing us at westernswithdad@gmail.com. And also, you can find every episode that we've done at our website, westernswithdad.com. That has everything that we've done, all 49 episodes. This is number 49, Dad.
Wow.
If you go to iTunes, it's only got about half of those. You can get them all off our website. But while you're at iTunes, you can leave us ratings and reviews there, because that helps the profile of the podcast and... lets people know about it. It's It's just a nice thing if you want to do it. So yeah, that's how you can reach us. And, you know, I'm not great at responding to emails, but I'm doing better. I'm trying. I will respond to any emails sent to us. Thank you very much for those. We really do appreciate them. Thank you.
Yes, thanks very much.
What else have you watched recently, Dad? What other films of late?
I've watched a couple of episodes of Godless.
Well, Godless.
And,
hold off on that, because next episode we'll be talking about Godless. That is the new Netflix Western series. I haven't seen any of it yet. I hear nothing but great things.
It's well done.
I'm very excited to talk about Godless next week, next 2 weeks from now, at the end of January. That will be the next episode of the podcast, Netflix Godless. Anything else you've seen recently, Dad?
Uh-huh. Oh, just some of the usual stuff on TV.
Been watching football?
You know, I haven't been watching football.
Yeah, it's just going to be the damn Patriots again. It's just going to happen, Patriots. And I'm already resigned to it. Uh-huh. There's nothing that can be done.
Awful. Who's coming up in the NFC to...
It's going to be a game between Minnesota and Philadelphia for the NFC championships. And this year, I am rooting for Minnesota. They won an incredible game yesterday. It was an absolutely beautiful playoff game. It was back and forth, and they won it in the last few seconds. It was heartbreaking for the Saints, I'm sure, but it was a really, really great win for the Vikings. So they are currently they have my sword right now. I'm all in on Vikings for this year.
You don't think Philadelphia's going to take it, huh?
I never think Philadelphia's going to take it. So no. my in-laws are big Eagles fans, and every year I'm just like, oh man, yeah, I'm sorry guys, it's not gonna happen. Don't get me wrong, I'd love that. That'd be great if the Eagles won, but I don't see it happening. They're the Eagles. So I watched a movie, Dad. I wanted to talk to you about. I watched a movie called Brawl in Cell Block 99, that I wanted to talk to you about.
Brawl in Cell Block 99.
I've been watching end of the year, best of the year kind of movies. You know, The Post. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. A lot of movies. I've liked them all. Everything I've seen, I've enjoyed quite a bit. It's been great. I've been catching up on them. The one I liked most was Brawl in Cell Block 99, which is
Over the Post and Three Billboards.
And I liked those a lot too. But Brawl in Cell Block 99 stars Vince Vaughn, who I've never liked before, but gives the best performance I've ever seen him give in this film.
Is it a comedy?
No, not at all. This is a prison film, like a prison exploitation crime movie. Basically, he's kind of like a good guy crook who ends up in prison. For ending up on the bad side of a drug transaction, wrong place at the wrong time kind of deal. And he's willing to serve his time, but then his wife gets kidnapped by a gangster and is like, you got to go kill somebody for me in cell block 99 at this other prison.
No.
And you got to get yourself shipped off there to this maximum security prison, or we're going to kill your wife. So he's got to like fight his way through a bunch of prisons to rescue his wife. It is directed and written by S. Craig Zahler, the man who made Bone Tomahawk. And it is very much that kind of movie. It is, in many, many ways, the prison movie version of Bone Tomahawk. One of my favorite episodes that we've done still. One of our first ones, which was a cannibal western starring Kurt Russell. Super violent, but really good. And Brawl in Cell Block 99, most of the things we said about Bone Tomahawk apply to that one as well. It's a delightful movie.
Oh, no.
It's pretty violent. It's really violent, in fact. It's not as violent as Bone Tomahawk, though. So I would recommend it to you, Dad. It's a really good film. Roll in Cell Block 99. Great, right, babe?
Oh, yeah, best.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so that'll do it for us. This is, you know, this is getting up there on. So let's cut this one off and come back in 2 weeks to speak about Godless on Netflix.
All right.
Yeah. Uh huh. That's good, right, Dad? It's fun.
That's good. Okay. All right. Adios, amigos.
Bye. Da ba da 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 da